suspects currently held in Israeli jails without charge or trial. Israel extensively uses its notorious administrative detention policy against Palestinians. That policy allows the regime to hold the inmates indefinitely without providing any evidence of wrongdoing. The notorious detention policy in Palestine is nothing new. It has been ongoing for many decades. It dates back to the British mandate and has since been used by the Israeli regime.
The British developed it to crush the Palestinian anti-colonial movement when Britain was the colonial power until 1948. The Israelis have picked it up, they have refined it, they play cat and mouse with hundreds and hundreds of prisoners, as you say, detained without charge, and who are sometimes even taken to the very day of their release, sometimes even allowed outside the prison gates and immediately snatched, kidnapped and taken back inside for another 6 month period.
For Palestinians, spending time in Israeli jails is a common experience. Some estimates show around one-fifth of the total Palestinian population has gone through detention in Israeli jails since 1967. That's over 700,000 people. There are currently several thousand Palestinian inmates, including a large number of children in Israeli prisons. Appalling conditions and harsh treatment are indispensable parts of the terrible experience. Many Palestinian inmates say Israeli forces tortured them while in custody. Many have also complained of medical negligence. Reports show inmates who suffer from dangerous chronic illnesses are only given painkillers. Meanwhile, poor prison conditions are making incarceration increasingly dangerous during the coronavirus pandemic. For instance, dozens of Palestinian prisoners have tested positive for the highly contagious disease inside the Israeli prison of Gilboa. Those with pre-existing health conditions could easily lose their lives. Protests against unbearable prison conditions have grown in recent years, including several high-profile hunger strikes, but they have rarely forced Israel to take action.
We need to start telling their stories, because the story of the prisoners is the story of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. It's a central aspect of that struggle, and I think we need to tell that story. We need to organize in a way where groups in different countries around the world can focus on particular groups of Palestinian prisoners, men, women, children, and tell their story and tell the whole world the horrors that Palestinians suffer.
The international community has been pretty loud in condemning Israel's violation of human rights against the Palestinians, including the rights violations inside its prisons. But the verbal condemnation has done little to change the regime's behavior. This could have been much different if governments had used their economic leverage with Israel to pressure it to change direction.
The French police are one of the toughest and most brutal in Europe when it comes to the use of force, with multiple examples of this demonstrated by the likes of the Compagnie Républicaine de Sécurité, or the elite CRS, when dealing with the various waves of protests that have marred the presidency of Emmanuel Macron, and is why the French public and media have turned to real-time technology to film the brutality demonstrated by the French police and security apparatus. The resulting anger demonstrated in various protests across the country against the bill has quite rightly angered the French, who expect some form of transparency in the way their country is run, how public services such as the police deal with situations, and also important is the notion of being able to justify such use of force, which, as we saw in the US with the murder of George Floyd, only takes a moment's lapse in concentration to breach the thin blue line. With the ability to film and photograph any moment with the use of a smartphone and cameras, the French appear to want to hide the actions of the police, meaning Article 24 of the new bill now makes it illegal to distribute images of police officers on duty, especially if it may harm their physical or mental integrity. But what about the integrity of the officers themselves acting out their duties? Should that not also be something that should be open to scrutiny? A recent example of police brutality in France is the recent removal of migrants who were camping in Place de la République in Paris's 12th arrondissement, in which bystanders and witnesses describe the amount of force used by the police as shocking, once again raising the question as to just what kind of security apparatus the French government wishes to deploy. But for many lawmakers in France, the introduction of the bill is also being met with some opposition, in particular within the French Parliament, with one lawmaker claiming that whilst it's acceptable that police officers should be able to complete their jobs without being threatened or harassed, at no point should public freedoms be breached, claiming that this bill may not change much at all, even when introduced. When the people took to the streets during the French Revolution, the motto following the toppling of the bourgeoisie became indoctrinated into the values that France still claim true today, namely the famous three words of liberté, égalité, and fraternité, or freedom, equality, and fraternity. Yet today, in modern France under Macron, all three of the coined terms appear to have less meaning, as the freedom to film the actions of the police in public places has been taken away. The equality between classes grows ever wider as Macron protects his elite friends from taxes at the expense of the poor. And fraternity is a joke as religious, racial and social discrimination run rife in France. The division in France has never been greater when it comes to religion, with France currently embroiled in yet another controversy as the publication of offensive cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad had been labelled as freedom of speech by Macron, much to the distaste of many who have taken to the streets around the world to protest this, and leaving religious leaders in France calling for some notion of unity, proving that Islam is a religion of peace. With Macron also causing huge division within France on other fronts, with the increase in duty on fuel sparking the Yellow Vest movement, and the failed policy on reforming the pension scheme costing the regular worker thousands of euros, it seems that with every step Macron takes, the more unpopular he becomes, with the so-called security bill just passed protecting the police, further cementing the fact. It can therefore be argued that Macron is the most unpopular president France has ever had, even surpassing the legacy left behind by François Hollande, as he divides his country, favours the elite, angers the international community, and essentially washes away his chances of being re-elected, needing a miracle over the next 2 years if he's really able to save his extremely fragile grip on his country.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
President-elect Joe Biden will have an all-female senior communications team at his White House, led by campaign communications director Kate Bedingfield. Kate Bedingfield will serve as Biden's White House communications director, and Jen Psaki, a longtime Democratic spokeswoman, will be his press secretary. Biden, whose office said he would receive his first presidential intelligence briefing on Monday, also plans to name a woman as director of the Office of Management and Budget. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Associated Press. The piece is titled, Joe Biden Announces All-Female Media Team at His White House. Stay with us for more. President-elect Joe Biden will have an all-female senior communications team at his White House, led by campaign communications director Kate Bedingfield. Kate Bedingfield will serve as Joe Biden's White House communications director, and Jen Psaki, a longtime Democratic spokeswoman, will be his press secretary. Biden, whose office said he would receive his first presidential intelligence briefing on Monday, also plans to name a woman as director of the Office of Management and Budget. Neera Tanden, the president and chief executive of the Center for American Progress, a liberal think tank, will be given the job of overseeing the implementation of Joe Biden's policies, according to a person familiar with the transition process. All three women are veterans of the Obama administration. Kate Bedingfield served as communications director for Biden whilst he was vice president. Jen Psaki was a White House communications director and a spokesperson at the State Department. And Neera Tanden served as a senior advisor to Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. Communicating directly and truthfully to the American people is one of the most important duties of a president, and this team will be entrusted with the tremendous responsibility of connecting the American people to the White House, Joe Biden said in a statement. These qualified, experienced communicators bring diverse perspectives to their work and a shared commitment to building this country back better, he added. Karine Jean-Pierre, who was Vice President-elect Kamala Harris's Chief of Staff, will serve as a Principal Deputy Press Secretary for the President-elect. She is another Obama Administration alumni, having served as a Regional Political Director for the White House Office of Political Affairs. Pili Tobar, who was Communications Director for the coalitions on Biden's campaign, will be his Deputy White House Communications Director. In a short statement released on Sunday regarding Biden's plans for the following day, his office said that following the briefing, Joe Biden would meet with advisors. Meanwhile, there are reports that Joe Biden has fractured his right foot after slipping whilst playing with his dog, Major. The injury was discovered in a scan on Sunday, 29th of November, and will likely require him to wear a boot for several weeks, according to his doctor. Biden suffered an injury on Saturday, 28th of November, and visited an orthopedist in Newark, Delaware, on Sunday afternoon, his office said. Initial x-rays did not show any obvious fracture, but medical staff ordered a more detailed CT scan, his doctor Kevin O'Connor said in a statement. The subsequent CT scan found tiny fractures of two small bones in the middle of his right foot, Dr. O'Connor said. It is anticipated that he will likely require a walking boot for several weeks, according to Dr. Kevin O'Connor. Fractures are a concern generally as people age, but Joe Biden's fracture appears to be a relatively mild one based on his doctor's statement and the planned treatment. At 78 years old, he will be the oldest president when he's inaugurated in January. Biden often dismissed questions about his age during the campaign. Reporters covering the president-elect were not afforded the opportunity to see Biden enter the doctor's office on Sunday, despite multiple requests. Leaving the doctor's office to head to an imaging center for a CT scan, Joe Biden was visibly limping, though he walked without a crutch or other aid. Biden will be the oldest person to assume the American presidency when he's sworn in next year, and his health is likely to be watched closely by both allies and opponents alike.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome. This is News Bulletin. My name is Amina Taylor, and we're coming to you from the British capital. Now, please stay with us as we delve into the day's top stories and social media talking points. But our top story. The European Union has condemned the assassination of a top Iranian scientist. Brussels says the killing was a criminal act, but the bloc is urging all sides to practice restraint as tensions between Iran and the United States and Israel escalate once more. U.S. President Donald Trump, a staunch ally of Tel Aviv, leaves the White House in just a few weeks, and some say this might be a last-ditch attempt at provoking an escalation with Iran, as Bianca Rahimi reports.
Today, Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was laid to rest. He was assassinated on Friday near the capital, Tehran. Iran has vowed to avenge the killing. On the day of the attack, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif urged the international community, especially the European Union, to abandon its shameful double standard and condemn this, quote, act of state terror. The European Union made its position clear in an official post on its website Saturday. This is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights the EU stands for. The EU is calling for all sides to practice restraint, though, saying this is a sensitive time. Germany has urged all sides not to allow the last weeks of Donald Trump's presidency in the US to obliterate hopes for fresh negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. The United Kingdom, however, has been less inclined to condemn the attack.
Well, look, we are concerned about the situation in Iran and the wider region. We do want to see de-escalation of tensions, and obviously, particularly, we want to try and find a route through on the nuclear dossier. I met with my E3 colleagues, so France and Germany, in Berlin this week. That kind of, it's a good example, that kind of cooperation, notwithstanding all the Brexit process, keeps going on. We're still waiting to see the full facts, trying to ascertain the full facts of what's happened in Iran. But I would say that we stick to the rule of international humanitarian law, which is very clear against targeting civilians.
Israel's lobby in the UK is strong, and British politicians are very careful not to offend the Zionist regime. The New York Times says Israel was behind the attack, citing an American official and two intelligence sources. Tel Aviv has carried out a number of assassination operations against Iranian nuclear scientists over the past decade, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu mentioned Dr. Fakhrizadeh by name in one of his presentations in 2018.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name.
U.S. President Donald Trump, who withdrew the U.S. from a landmark Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and has imposed new sanctions on Iran since, has only a few weeks left in the White House. There are indications his successor, Joe Biden, may have a different approach to diplomacy in the region and might go as far as rejoining the Iran nuclear deal and lifting some economic sanctions. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Masoud Zajari from the Islamic Human Rights Commission is with us more for this far-reaching story. Masoud, firstly, what is your reaction to the statements coming out of Europe and Westminster on this terror attack?
Well, unfortunately, it's too late, and I will say even too little. The reality is that, you know, they should condemn the act of terrorism without any sort of any further complication. The fact that they're coming out and saying that they're asking both sides or all sides to show restraint, it's actually a testimony that they know exactly who has committed these acts of crime. And it's because of that they're not going all the way in condemnation. And when it comes to the Britain, it really is outrageous. It's a shambles that again testifies that this was done by the Israelis, and this is why they are behaving the way they are behaving. It's almost like saying that, you know, they're scared that if they actually expose the criminals who committed this, they will be accused of anti-Semitism or something similar to that. This is outrageous.
What is also outrageous, Masoud, is the notion that perhaps Iranian scientists and officials might not even be safe on home territory. Your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's compare this with the situation of sort of alleged assassination of opposition in Russia, which took place in Russia itself. And it was a poisoning which never killed the individual. But nevertheless, the international community, and European in particular, were very firm and very sort of aggressive against Russia, even though there wasn't really much sort of evidence to prove this was the fact. Here, I think everybody knows, and the behavior of United States, Britain, and indeed even the rest of the world, talking about all sides should calm down and be careful. It actually shows very clearly they know who's done this, and the fact that they're not dealing with it, it sort of gives a message, not just to the Zionists, the State of Israel, but to the rest of the world, that international community is not willing, there's no political will to deal with this. And therefore, from now on, it will be law of the jungle.
Indeed, Masoud Zajari, as always, thank you very much, sir. And we move to other news now, this time across to France, where three French police officers suspended over the alleged beating of a black music producer will remain in custody as a formal investigation is carried out, this according to the prosecutor in Paris, Remy Heinz. Now, during the press conference, Mr. Heinz explained that judicial authorities wanted to ensure that the officers in question did not have contact with each other or exert pressure on any witnesses. His statement comes just a week after CCTV footage doing the rounds on social media showing the victims being beaten. The man, known only as Michel, sparked fresh claims of police brutality within the country. President Emmanuel Macron has deemed the video as unacceptable and shameful for France. Richard Sudan, we've gone from claims of state racism in France to accusations of the same, but this time closer to home. Now, anybody following this program will know that you did a rather impressive package on Friday talking about the proposed deportation flight that will have dozens of people from Black Caribbean backgrounds on it. And we're beginning to understand that this flight is still scheduled to go ahead despite lots of calls for it to be halted.
So we know so far that, as you rightly say, the flight is planned to go ahead on this Wednesday, the 2nd of December, despite a petition online gathering literally hundreds or thousands of signatures There's been celebrities and even MPs that have been writing to the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary urging this flight not to go ahead, because although the Home Office, the government and the right-wing press are really emphasising the most serious crimes allegedly committed by those on board, human rights lawyers and activists are basically saying they believe that the majority of the 50 or so Jamaicans on board actually haven't committed serious offences. We know that one person believed to be on board actually is believed to have committed a motoring offence, and it's believed actually that many or most on board actually have family ties in the UK or have been in the United Kingdom since they were children. And this of course is off the back of the fact that the government still hasn't implemented the findings of the Windrush inquiry, lessons learned review by Wendy Williams, and the Equalities and Human Rights Commission says that if this flight goes ahead, it does actually breach breaking the law. So it's a very serious situation indeed.
It certainly is, but we know that the British government is not afraid of breaking its own rules when it's politically expedient. What's been the online reaction to this, Richard?
I want to go first to a tweet from Lady Zelly, who says, despite the effects from the Windrush scandal, mass deportations still continue and uphold cruel and racist immigration policies. If black lives really matter to you, then where is your action and outrage? No borders, no person is illegal. And we have a reaction from Femi Fatusen, who says to the UK Home Office, these flights need to be cancelled. Mass deportation is not humane. The Windrush generation should not be made to bear the burden of the government's failures. Cut it out. Hashtag Jamaica 50, the hashtag being used in this campaign, Amina.
Of course, Priti Patel there following in the footsteps of her former colleague Savi Javid there, and also Theresa May maintaining this hostile environment. To your next story, Richard.
Well, speaking of hostile environments, another black teenager has been shot dead in the United States in Oregon. 19-year-old Aiden Ellison was shot to death in Oregon by Robert Keegan, who was 47. And this is a story which is gaining traction in the US. What's interesting is all of the mainstream media outlets are basically saying this killing was to do with a dispute over music, but it really begs the question, do people really believe that black men, black boys are shot dead in the United States over music being played too loud? Of course, there's an extremely heightened situation of racism, anti-black racism in the United States at the moment. So this story is gaining traction, Amina, and questions are being asked.
Could you bring us the online reaction? I really want to hear what people are saying about this story, Richard.
Well, on that very point, I mean, you're not the only person to make the connection with Jordan Davis. Anchor podcaster Gregory Vale says, this is what happened to that Jordan kid during Obama's administration. Jordan Davis, who was 17, was shot in 2012 in Jacksonville in Florida, where we know racism is rife in a similar case. And we also have a reaction from SS Mastering, who says, if it's in Oregon, you can bet your last dollar that it's a 99% racially motivated case, as the state is home to skinheads and white supremacist groups. It was also illegal for black people to even live there at one time, not too long ago, and their ways of hatred have not changed. And just to contrast what the police chief in Oregon said in charge of the case, Amina, with the newspaper headlines, the police chief said, I understand that there are legitimate tensions surrounding matters of violence against people of color in the United States, and this situation speaks directly to that.
Right, we'll leave it there. We'll of course be following not just this particular story, but others. Thank you very much, Richard Sudan. Now, if you've only been consuming your news from mainstream sources, first of all, naughty, naughty, but you might be forgiven for thinking that the Labour Party dodged a bullet when they turfed Jeremy Corbyn as their leader, because so mired was his name with claims of rampant anti-Semitism. And on today of all days, today's International Day of Solidarity with Palestine, Robert Carter goes digging for the evidence that the Labour leader was an anti-Semite.
The UK Labour Party has once again descended into a civil war, with the left wing of the party rebelling against the current leader of Labour, Keir Starmer, over his role in penalising his predecessor, socialist Jeremy Corbyn. this entire war between the left and right camps of the party has by and large centered around one key question. Is Jeremy Corbyn an anti-Semite? Many of the accusations against Corbyn relate to his past views and associations before he became leader, as well as his handling of allegations within the party after his election to the top post. These include criticism of Israeli oppression of the Palestinians and hosting or attending events with other outspoken critics of Israel, including a meeting where he shared a platform with a Holocaust survivor, an anti-Zionist political activist who compared Israeli actions in Gaza to elements of the Holocaust. In 2010, Corbyn did apologize for this event, stating,
"In the past, in pursuit of justice for the Palestinian people and peace in Israel and Palestine, I have on occasion appeared on platforms with people whose views I completely reject. I apologize for the concerns and anxiety that this has caused."
However, despite Corbyn's attempts to crack down on anti-Semitism, the media jumped on the chance to place full blame on Corbyn's shoulders in future interviews.
"Against the abuse they receive on the streets, on the trains, or in any
so
other,
no apology for
in
how you
any
handled
other
this
form of life."
And try one more time.
No,
no
hang
apology
on a minute, Andrew. I
just
and
say sorry.
Wait a minute. I and our party.
No, just say sorry.
Come on, let me say something.
Well,
our party.
I want you
and
to
my
say sorry.
And our party and me.
Yeah.
Do not accept anti-Semitism in any form.
So are you sorry for
obviously
anything?
Obviously.
Corbyn's supporters have rebuked many of the criticisms against him, citing Corbyn's decades-long support for anti-racism struggles, including the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, the left-wing efforts against British racism, and the Palestinian fight against Israeli apartheid.
Our party is united in condemning the shooting of hundreds of unarmed demonstrators in Gaza by Israeli forces and the passing of Israel's discriminatory nation-state law. The continuing occupation, the expansion of illegal settlements, and the imprisonment of Palestinian children are an outrage.
Also, by some astonishing coincidence, many of Corbyn's biggest critics are themselves outspoken supporters of Israel, including many Labour MPs, such as Keir Starmer himself.
"I don't describe myself as a Zionist, but I understand and I sympathise and I support Zionism."
Now, despite all of the accusations, Corbyn has never been charged with anti-Semitism and has never been proven to have said anything anti-Semitic himself. Yet, the label has stuck. This is despite the fact that Corbyn boasts many Jewish supporters who have rubbished the many claims against him.
"I'm Jewish, my whole family's Jewish. I can tell you that we're not scared. Corbyn is not an anti-Semite. The right-wing press takes things out of context, puts them in headlines.
It's a manipulation by an Israeli propaganda outfit, by the right wing of the party, of the Labour Party, and goodness knows who else.
Everybody makes mistakes, and I think he's made mistakes. But he hasn't become an anti-Semite. He doesn't support anti-Semitism. He loathes it, as every right-thinking person does."
Also, what rarely gets mentioned is Corbyn's long history of helping Jewish causes before becoming leader of the party, including his signing of numerous early day motions condemning anti-Semitism, his 1987 campaign to reverse Islington Council's decision to destroy a Jewish cemetery, and in 2010 called on the UK government to facilitate the settlement of Yemeni Jews to Britain. So with all that said, I leave you with this question. If it's true that Corbyn is and always has been a rabid anti-Semite, then why is it proven harder than expected to maintain his suspension from the party?
Robert Carter there, cutting to the chase. Into Italy we go now, where at least three people have been killed by flooding on the island of Sardinia. This according to authorities in the local media. In Bitti, a town in the province of Nuoro, streets were turned into rivers of mud, which covered cars and flooded cellars. A 55-year-old farmer was killed by a landslide, and a 90-year-old man died at home, according to the Italian news agency ANSA. Emergency services are still searching for the body of a woman in her 90s, amongst others. Talks between the European Union and the United Kingdom have resumed over the weekend as both sides continue to push on in efforts to strike a trade deal before the end of the year. The EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, is currently in London as negotiations are set to go down to the wire. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said the UK will prosper with or without a deal, but the economic harm and disruption will be inevitable. Competition rules and fishing rights continue to be areas of disagreement between Brussels and London. Any deal between the two sides will need to be ratified by Parliament before December the 31st. It seems Robert Inlakesh, Donald Trump, is sending his very best people to go sort out the issues in the Middle East. Alas, it turns out this list is helmed by the man married to his daughter, Jared Kushner. Explain.
Well, Jared Kushner, a man who seems to affect everything and turn it into garbage that he touches in terms of diplomacy, who's been an absolute failure when it comes to diplomacy, is headed off to Qatar to try and host talks between Saudi Arabia and Qatar to try and ease this ongoing feud that's been going on since really 2017. It's been going on for 3 years, and it seems like Saudi Arabia does not want to really engage meaningfully with Qatar. But if this was able to be pulled off, this would mean that Saudi Arabia would have to effectively isolate the United Arab Emirates, who have been on a campaign to isolate and really destroy the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood inside of the Middle East. On top of this as well, Qatar would have to perhaps pull away from Iran further, isolate itself from Iran, take a more aggressive stance towards Iran. That's perhaps what we would see if the two came together. And also on top of this, we saw that in 2017, Qatar was actually forced by Saudi Arabia to stop supporting Hamas for a while. And what happened there is because of a lack of funding going to the Gaza Strip, Hamas is the elected government in Gaza, people were suffering greatly. So it really doesn't look like a positive thing. And it's a good job such a terrible statesperson is there.
All right. Very quick on the tweets, Samira.
The first one we have here says, Jared Kushner and his team are hoping to use their dwindling political leverage to advance issues of U.S. interest, with a particular focus on resolving the three-year-old rift between Qatar and its Persian Gulf neighbors. We got another one here as well from a user called Ahmed, who says, Jared Kushner is completely useless as a statesperson. Kushner being in power shows how stupid Trump is. How could you let someone so incompetent do his job? If Trump wants war against Iran, he will lose badly with this team behind him.
All right, quick story there in the United States with the president-elect's woke team.
Well, many people have pointed to this and said this is basically like having, you know, a transgender slave owner running a slave plantation. You know, you're putting this trendy face on a massive war machine which is going around the world and massacring innocent civilians. And there's no real point in having so many women and so many people of color in government if they don't represent the majority views of their communities, their given communities. If you're having such a diverse group of people in there, if they're all carbon copies of Condoleezza Rice, what's the why not just have a whole bunch of old white men in there if all of them think like old white men who are taking money from corporations and pushing for all the lobby interests? You know, placing in people who just look a certain way doesn't do anything. We saw that Barack Obama, being the first black president, did little to nothing for African Americans, and that should have been an issue that he was at least strong on, but he wasn't. He lied about everything from creating peace with the Palestinians to withdrawing from Iraq, which he didn't do, just like Trump hasn't done.
Indeed, didn't close Guantanamo either, as I recall. Reactions online to this one, Rob?
The first one is we have here is from Rania Khalik, who is a journalist in the United States. She says, Biden putting women in charge of U.S. imperialism is not feminism. It's just putting a female face on the same cruel and destructive policies that impoverish and kill people around the world. We have another one here as well from a Twitter user called Rob, who says, the hollowness of bourgeoisie identity politics harnessed to the war machine.
Right, somebody did their political science degree with that tweet. Robert Inlakesh, we'll leave it there. Thank you so very much. And of course, thank you for staying the course with us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, we discussed Imam Khomeini's style of teaching in brief. We said that he was very humble in hearing to the criticism of his students and also encouraged them to have a critical spirit rather than accepting what is taught very easily. However, he would never let anyone waste the time of the class for trivial and lengthy debates. It is vital for teaching to have three features to be effective. First, teaching should be based on a specific aim. The teacher should know what he is seeking and where he wants to reach. Secondly, there should be a reciprocal relation between the teacher and the student. Unilateral teaching and monologue is rarely effective and fruitful. The student should be involved in the course of teaching. Thirdly, the teacher should provide easy and suitable opportunities for learning to enable the student to learn the material in the easiest way. Experts of education have divided teaching's techniques into four categories. The first technique is teaching based on direct conveying of information. The second technique is based on interaction and involvement. The third one is problem-oriented, and the fourth one is individual teaching. Although it is not simple to refer one of these techniques over others, experts maintain that the interactive technique is the best and most successful method. The interactive technique is characterized by active teaching. In this method, the activity of the learner or student is highly emphasized. This is why it is also called active method technique. In other words, the student has a very active role in class. He or she participates in discussions and raises his or her view on various issues, trying to solve problems. He or she gathers experiences from the teacher and is guided by the teacher. The teacher does not behave as a superior authority, but as a guide and director. This method leads to thriving of creativity and talents of students rather than bringing up lethargic and passive students. Imam Khomeini's method of teaching was very active and discussion-oriented. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat said, "When the Imam raised an issue for discussion, both Arab and non-Arab ulema would come. Imam Khomeini would let them debate. Some would say that he hadn't had this method in Qom and had started it in Najaf. He would allow debates in public sessions. Sometimes the Imam himself would participate in the discussion so that even students like me could debate with him. But if there was a debate among friends, he would keep silent and listen unless when his opinion was asked. Then he would participate in the debate. His method was quite honorable and vital for us." Thank you. Dear listeners, one of the factors that making classes non-interactive is the scientific vanity of the teacher. Scientific vanity prevents active participation of students in scientific debates and blocks the way of progress. According to all of his classmates and students, Imam Khomeini was devoid of any scientific vanity, and this had made his classes the most active classes among seminaries. Ayatollah Qadiri says, "The Imam would show no negative reaction to good words. He was never seen to have scientific vanity towards his knowledge. He would say, maybe this is correct, maybe that is correct." Late Ayatollah Abdul Karim Musavi Ardabili said, "Imam Khomeini never had scientific vanity. In his books, he would not use phrases or words to denote that he had plunged in scientific vanity to have the connotation that nobody could understand as much as he could." Dear friends, Imam Khomeini was a good listener to the audience of his words, especially those who would object his words and writings. Late Ayatollah Abbas Ali Zanjani said, "Anyone who talked at the Imam's class, even the young students who were raising an objection, the Imam would give them opportunity and would listen to them. This would train the students in this way. I have seen this characteristic in Imam Khomeini's class and even his ordinary dealings. When someone wanted to tell him something, he would listen to him exactly and with full attention." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, used to teach in a way to bring up his students self-confident. Ayatollah Mazahiri says, "The Prophet of Islam would behave with his companions in a way that each of them thought that he was the dearest for him. Imam Khomeini was like this in his teaching. He would regard his students with high esteem so that their talents would flourish. He would accept a good word and thank for it." Ayatollah Mubahedi Kermani says, "Imam Khomeini taught in Masjid-e-Azam, that is the great mosque in Qom. At the end of the class, he would sit for a while and people would gather around him. I raised the objection that I had in my mind. The Imam was silent for a short while. Then he said, 'I have to think.' This is very humble. In these cases, professors usually give an answer immediately so that their scientific status is not hurt before the student. But the Imam showed humbleness and said, 'I have to think.'" Dear listeners, next time we will continue this discussion.
Around the World with Reporters.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People was designated by the United Nations on November 29 in 1977. The day is marked every year internationally with rallies and activities aimed at drawing attention to the struggle of the Palestinian people. This year, a protest was held in the village of Khan al-Ahmar that is under a threat again to be demolished by the Israeli military. On this day, Palestinians assured they will continue to defend their lands amid calls by the Palestine Liberation Organization to enable the Palestinians to exercise their right to self-determination and their independent state.
"We are still struggling to protect our basic rights against Israeli regime violence. Meanwhile, our dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. We have come here to voice our protest against Israel's aggression. We are the real owners of these lands."
This year, however, Palestinians say they were left alone struggling the Israeli occupation and its non-stop attempts to annex more lands, mainly after some Arab states have signed normalization deals with Tel Aviv. These ties, Palestinians say, simply undermine efforts for Palestinian state. Palestinian officials stress that what they see as a symbolic international solidarity has failed to give the Palestinian people their rights, while Israel continues to occupy most of the land of historical Palestine.
Israel will not be deterred by statements of condemnation. Israel can be stopped only by popular nonviolent Palestinian struggle and boycott, divestment, sanctions against its system of apartheid. That's what we want to see. BDS, not normalization with occupation.
The UN, meanwhile, has renewed commitment to the Palestinian people. However, its Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has cautioned that the prospects for a viable two-state solution are becoming more distant, mainly with Israel's expansion of illegal settlements, a significant spike in the demolition of Palestinian homes and structures, violence, and continued militant activity. After more than 40 years since the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the UN, Palestinian rights remain usurped and the dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Venezuela's judiciary has convicted a group of former oil executives who plotted with the U.S. government against the interests of the South American country Citgo Petroleum Corporation, which is based in the United States. The judicial ruling comes at a time when Caracas is fighting to regain control of Citgo, as the company was illegally confiscated by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. Citgo's former executives were found guilty of passing secret information to American authorities in order to inflict damage on Venezuela's oil industry, a misconduct that is regarded as a major crime in Venezuela. In this scenario, officials support the judicial verdict.
The judge's decision is aimed at protecting our country's oil industry from U.S.-funded spies like ex-Citgo executives.
On the flip side, the opposition criticizes this legal case.
There is not enough evidence of conspiracy between the former executives and the U.S., so this court ruling is politically motivated.
Nonetheless, experts say the country's judiciary issued the right verdict.
The former executives are the Venezuelans who hold U.S. citizenship. That's a felony itself, in case you are the manager of a Venezuelan company.
Venezuela's judiciary has punished the former oil executives for their complicity with the U.S. Analysts say this is part of Caracas's legal actions to get back Citgo, the oil company that was illegally confiscated by Washington. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
A human tide, rarely seen, flooded in the streets of Paris and all over France in a freedom march against a new security law. The massive protest is held against President Macron's government that is pushing a new bill that restricts the ability to film police. Human rights associations and media are unanimous. This law would allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished.
There's a huge popular opposition against this law. Even the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations and other international bodies criticize it. A social majority in this country refuses the implementation of this law. Since a long time, we alert the government on police brutality and violence against women. Violence against women during the lockdown is exploding, and the government remains inactive and guilty.
Two major events this week plead in favor of the protesters and of the importance of video footage to denounce police violence. First, French police dismantled a migrant camp in central Paris. The French government ordered an internal police investigation after police officers were filmed tossing migrants out of tents and intentionally tripping one while evacuating a protest camp.
It is important to film this kind of situations because it's part of freedom of expression. Filming with our phones is almost the only way of publishing this kind of violence against migrants, people from the suburb, against everybody.
And then a second video showed the violent arrest of a black music producer in Paris. Three police officers repeatedly punched and hit him during 20 minutes. The man told that the officers made racist insults.
Thanks to the images showing the beating by a kind of private militia attacking a music producer, the truth has come out. Without this video footage from a surveillance camera, the man would be in prison accused for using violence against the police. That shows the importance of having a counter power in this country.
Under a huge pressure, Interior Minister Darmanin announced disciplinary proceedings as soon as possible, but that might be too little, too late. In the meantime, the protest is going on.
A large majority in the French parliament voted in favor of the security law, but the Senate still has to approve it. Right-wing senators, a majority in the Senate, declared they will rewrite the law because it is unconstitutional. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese have bid farewell to their last democratically elected prime minister, who died of COVID-19-related complications at 84. According to the National Umma Party, which he led until his days, Sadiq al-Mahdi died in hospital in the United Arab Emirates, where he was receiving treatment after becoming infected with the novel coronavirus in October.
I think the loss of the Sadiq al-Mahdi, the Umma Party leader, and the Sudanese, the most intellectual person in the Sudanese political process, is so great loss. It will be reflecting on all and hold the political process.
You know, Sadiq is the greatest one in the Sudan, and this era need him. Why? Because according to the government,
Al-Mahdi served as a prime minister in the mid-60s and again in the mid-80s before he was overthrown in a coup of 1989, which led to rise power of President Omar al-Bashir. After being forced out of office, Al-Mahdi remained a leading politician in Sudan. In a statement, Sudan Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok described him as one of the most important figures of thought, politics, literature and wisdom in the country. Meanwhile, senior National Umma Party said that the party will continue to follow the anti-Israel policies taken by the late Sadiq al-Mahdi.
We have our own doctrine based on the Islamic ethics. We are against the normalization. If the needs arise, not al-Burhan, neither Hamdok will decide on behalf of the Sudanese people. The coming elected parliament will decide on the behalf of the Sudanese nation.
I think this constitution will go in the same road of the leader Sadiq al-Mahdi. In the normalization, against the normalization or any establishment of the relationship between the Sudan and Israel.
Al-Mahdi was a well-known Sudanese political figure who played an important role in public affairs and wrote several books addressing the situation in Sudan.
For more than 60 decades, Sadiq al-Mahdi was an icon of democracy, Islamic thought, and a strong opponent of imperialism in Sudan and abroad. Mohammed Fazari, from Khartoum, Twin City of Omdurman.
At 2:30 p.m. local time on Friday, in a countryside area east of Tehran, a truck loaded with explosives blew up to intercept the car carrying top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Eyewitnesses say five or six gunmen then rushed from a nearby vehicle and opened fire on his car. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but medics were unable to save his life. The incident immediately sent its shockwaves across Iran and beyond, with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif calling the attack an act of terror and linking it to Israel. Inside Iran, the assassination comes as a shock. Less than 24 hours after the incident, people from all walks of life gathered outside the Iranian parliament to condemn the assassination, which they view as grave as the U.S.'s assassination of top IRGC commander Qasem Soleimani in January.
What happened to our nuclear scientist was carried out by the same terrorists who killed Qasem Soleimani. Like Mr. Soleimani, Fakhrizadeh offered many services to our nation.
If we back down on this terrorist act, the U.S. and Israel will become more insolent towards us. We have gathered here to urge the government and lawmakers to take a tough stance towards the perpetrators to avoid further such incidents.
Fakhrizadeh served as the head of the Research and Innovation Organization of